Kia ora koutou, it's 11 on Sunday. You're listening to Art Bank.
Good morning.
Kia ora everyone, how's it going out there? Happy Sunday to you. Art Bank this week's going to be a goodie. Got Dan Nash in the studio. He's got work all over town at the moment, so we're looking forward to hearing about his shows that are on at Room and Art Space. Theo, you've been out talking to an artist at Te Tuhi.
Yep, I've been talking to Jim Noble, whose show Dream Dialects is on at the moment, along with shows by a huge number of artists, actually. Te Tuhi's got very, very strong program at the moment.
Cool, yeah. That's later in the show. We're looking forward to that. I've got to say, I do enjoy my Sunday mornings. Coming into the studio is a bit of a ritual for me. It's not quite churchy, but you know, I can see the people out there going to church, and you know, I always enjoy it. The ritual for me at the moment is going to the bakery. I always like going to the bakery before coming into BFM, and I guess it was a kind of, you know how you get atheists coming into the church and questioning stuff? I guess my ritual is the bakery, and somebody came in and questioned the bakery real hard this morning, just with one question. They just went up to the counter and asked, as I was biting into my sausage roll, they just asked the person behind the counter, what is in a sausage roll? And it broke me. I just didn't know what to say. I just heard everything in the sausage roll that I was biting into, and it made me want to go vegan. So there you go. We've got a little
song lined up.
Tune lined up. So that was my little morning sausage roll spiel. Get that out of the way.
And here's, by request, the Beach Boys' Wild Honey.
Yeah.
As our mics were off for all of that time.
Okay.
Hey, y'all. That's, yeah. Oh, we've got calls coming through and everything. Ah, Dan. Technical difficulties all around.
Okay.
Sorry, that was a little double up of Beach Boys with Darlin', and then we had... I just did a full introduction to Dan's show at Room Gallery, which I went along to the other night. I don't know if you... I guess you couldn't hear that. Sorry, team. Well. Okay, so Dan's show at Room Gallery is... it's a film... A lot of imagery of the Port Hills. There's a little bit of your granddad in there. Some homemade music. I'm going to say it's homemade.
Would yeah,
that be right?
Yeah, it was for that video.
Yeah, and so what's the name of the film?
The film is called Q. What does a border collie eat? A luckily fine powder.
Cool. That's a sort of a little teasing opener because I was kind of waiting for the dog imagery and then it did come out eventually.
Yeah, there's heaps of dogs in it. Video.
Yeah. What was the sort of start point when you started making that film?
I kind of had like a whole archive of music to start with.
Yeah.
And it was kind of built around trying to find footage that corresponded with the audio.
Right. Yeah. So I guess when you sort of start off, your How would you describe the music if you're starting with the music? It's kind of like a dubstepy kind of I don't know.
It's like it's quite tinny and like obnoxious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Childish.
Yeah.
But fantasy.
Yeah. And then the imagery itself that sort of stems out, I guess you could use those words to describe the imagery as well. There was a child in there as well.
I think that was in the last video.
Was in the last video.
Lots of family.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of my sister's dog.
Yeah, yeah. And you spent a bit of time down in Christchurch in Littleton. There's a kind of nautical Port Hillsy vibe to all the... All the background imagery.
It was kind of Christchurch. Well, I had a show in Christchurch where I made a video that was kind of the first of the series, and this one was probably like a sequel to that.
Yeah. Oh, cool. I was really taken with the film, and the way it sort of worked in unison with Sophie Bannon's film was quite interesting. Sophie Bannon had a film that screened just before your work, and that was it was tied in with an artist. Do you know the name of the artist that she was referencing?
Yeah.
It was sort of a similar kind of film. It was imagery of the outback in rural New South Wales, and with text played over the top, and it was sort of tying in with an artist who'd shot over to Australia from New Zealand back in the 40s, I think.
Rosalie Gascoigne is her name.
And Rosalie was sort of one of those artists that has gone out of the canon, I guess, but is just being talked about again, and Sophie has been over studying her legacy in Sydney, so... I don't know, the way that the two films played out together, I to be honest, I didn't know exactly whose film was what, and I was trying to sort of like slowly work it out, and I could sort of see Sophie's influences coming in, and I could sort of see that it was definitely like Dan time when your music hit, and like suddenly there was a sonic element to the room, and yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was quite interesting, because Sophie's video was really... it had a really slow pace and it was very mellow.
Yeah.
And it had no audio.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, and then mine just is like screaming for 4 minutes or something.
Yeah.
Just kind of like in some shows, it's usually curated around like a kind of like speed or something, a rhythm that's usually the same.
Yeah.
So it was kind of cool to have like that change.
Yeah.
And then people were kind of, yeah, so you have like a break and then it comes in really intensely with my video.
Yeah.
And then you can like reflect again.
Yeah. Yeah,
and read Sophie's words.
Yeah,
yeah.
Were you kind of reading anything when you were making that work, or was there some kind of like outside influence or artist influence that was coming into the work? Or
with that, I did that video in a really short amount of time.
Yeah,
like it was kind of like a real messy, intuitive, automatic kind of process.
Sure. Yeah.
So no, I was kind of just making the video for like 4 days or something.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you were kind of vibing off instinct then and going off what you do best or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. One of the reasons, I suppose, that you only had 4 days was that you also have work on at Art Space as well.
Yeah.
So you would have been really busy with that. So that's part of John Mutombu's curated show up at Art Space. What was the work at Art Space?
The work at Art Space was like a lot more elaborate, sculpture, and some digital prints that I made.
Yep.
There's like a piece of fiction that's on the walls, kind of in these like big illustrated kind of posters, and then welded metal forms of channels, and then a big cage that's about the size, like a human-sized cage.
Yeah. And so this fiction, was it all on the wall there? I couldn't really work out, was that an extract from a longer piece that you'd written?
No, it's all on the wall.
Really?
It's quite heavily edited, though.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And what are we dealing with the fiction? Is there a narrative that you can let us into there?
Yeah, the narrative's kind of about this, it's kind of like a really, like, it's kind of like a castaway story or like a desert island story, but really kind of spacey or something. Like, there's no name of the character, there's no gender to the character, and it's all in present tense. And it's, about someone called the individual and then someone called the figure, and the figure's kind of like this extreme outside force that causes the world to kind of go insane, and the individual is kind of like this preserved figure in that chaos.
Yeah, wow. That's something that sounds very interesting to me, because I'm also making castaway art at the moment as well.
Yeah.
So I love the idea of the island as a kind of is it just a spot in the world where it's all about one person, really, when it's a human-sized space, I guess.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add a little interesting thing. That's also what Jim Noble's show is about.
Oh, really? Wow.
it's pertinent to New Zealand or something.
Yeah.
There's a thematic consistency or something to grab onto here.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. So is there a conversation between the individual and... So what are the two characters, sorry?
The individual and the figure.
And the figure. Is there a sort of correspondence between the two of them, or...?
Yeah, because at the beginning, the individual's kind of, like, isolated on a raft, and the figure kind of emerges from the ocean and then kind of makes, like, the sea rejects all its life and then kind of, like, gets all mixed up into a smoothie. And then the figure disappears, and the individual's just kind of like starting to crack mentally, and it just all unfolds from that.
Wow.
So it's kind of like the trigger for the breakdown.
Yeah, yeah. And then is there a relationship between this text work and then the channel sculptures that are on the floor?
Yeah, I kind of wanted those to be like really, like, almost like reading aids or something, like something that you have. So when you're reading something, there's always these kind of like concepts, like enclosed spaces and open spaces, movement of bodies, movement of materials. So I just wanted those to be like really, like, just guide the reading or something, or make it kind of more realistic.
Sure, yeah. They also have a very nautical feel to them as well. They kind of, I was getting a kind of a boat, like a boat vibe off those channels, I guess, and sort of reading it into the work, like, on that level. So.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to make a shipwreck to start with, but I got talked out of it.
Right, yeah. I guess that's for the viewer to decide whether it's a hypothetical shipwreck. Hey, let's jump into a little tune for a while, shall we, and just sort of have a breather. Sorry about all the technical difficulties at the start of that interview, but hey, that's how it goes sometimes. This is Julie's Place, Rolling Blackouts.
I lay down through the cycle of wild.
listening to Artbank.
95BFM and the K Road Business Association presents First Thursday's Carnival. Thursday, the 1st of December, from 6 till 9pm on K Road, don your masks, sew some bells onto your shoulder pads, and get amongst as the famous strip comes alive carnival style. Samba dances, steel drums, and street food, art markets, and weird and wonderful workshops are all on the agenda as retailers and revelers alike come out to play on good old K Road. First Thursday's Carnival, coming soon. For more information, head to kroad.com or have a look-see on Facebook. Proudly sponsored by K Road Business Association and Iron Bank.
As we go about our waking lives in the subtropical metropolitan dreamscape that is contemporary Auckland, it's easy to imagine the rest of the country as a barren wasteland. Good only for wind farming, the storage of archaic law enforcement computer systems, flailing blue-collar industry, and prisons. But you'd be dead wrong. There's more to Greater New Zealand than Gudzu Vlakis and Lanark Castle, and we are determined to prove it. Every Saturday, tune in as the Totally Wired team check in with correspondents from around Aotearoa to get the guts on happenings in the nation's provinces. NZ On Air Music presents Main Centred every Saturday between 11 and 2 as part of Totally Wired.
Art Bank 95 BFM on Sunday morning. That was a little tune. I can't even remember what it was called now, but that's cool. That's cool. We've got another one coming up. This is the sound of Dan Nash, who's the artist up here in studio. What are we going to listen to here, Dan?
This is the audio from a film I made for North Projects.
Okay.
In Christchurch.
Cool.
A quiet weekend in Capri. This is named after a really low-budget computer game made by this couple in Capri that's basically like a slideshow walking around Capri.
Cool. That sounds amazing. So, wait, where is Capri in the world?
Capri is the Amalfi Coast, off the coast of Italy.
Yeah.
And it's pretty pristine.
Okay. And do you feel that you have captured that vibe in the song, or is it kind of the opposite?
It's kind of influenced by that. Yeah. Well, there's a interview there's a reading of a poem by John Fowles in there.
Okay.
And he wrote the book The Magus, which is kind of like set on a made up Greek island.
Okay.
So that's kind of the connection.
Oh, hilarious. All right. Well, here it is, A Quiet Weekend in Capri.
Use it as an observation and turn it into art.
Mm.
So you've got to say, I'm suffering this, so therefore I'm going to work on my picture, you know, and then just keep doing that. And then after a while...
until it enveloped the planet the humans call Earth. It sucked the very life force from the planet and renewed the energies of its masters, the ancients, for another eon. All is lost. All is lost.
Yeah, you're not going to do it. mere shadows, flickers, frantic scrabbles of total futility. Lost in a hollow, computerized hell. Sounds purpose. Point. Sounds even God. Why seek we further than these febrile things to see? When there are Homer's wind-up waves, so deep, so blue, so dark, profound, whose endless, empty passing sings a seal.
So that was an excerpt from A Quiet Weekend in Capri, a work that was at North Projects in Christchurch earlier in the year. It has a lot of gaming influences as well in the sounds. Do you like play many computer games, or do you just vibe off their audio tracks?
Yeah, I definitely did when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Or that type of computer game, like adventure games, you know, like the Monkey Island and stuff.
And it almost becomes a kind of sort of the footage in that film is not necessarily about like specific adventures, but then it sort of becomes, you're hoping that whoever's in the film suddenly becomes like the hero of the movie or something, just because of the backing track. It's like, oh, that's the hero, I hope they do all right. kind of thing. So the footage in that film was very varied, but there was
there's a lot of sort of what seems like point of view, which kind of puts you in the position of this, I guess, connects through into that solitary figure, solitary view of the world. Even unreliable narrator, sort of, because you've got this manipulation of emotion through music.
Totally. I thought it was quite an exploitative film or something, in that it was like made to be for people to like really vibe on it.
Mm. Like, you wanted to have those moments of, like, resonation.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a word.
But it's quite simple or something. It's, like, maybe... I don't know. I just want it to be simple and consumable and kind of, you know.
Because, I haven't been watching Westworld, but I've been reading a lot about how they use Radiohead in a really interesting way, where, like, they manufacture emotion entirely, but it's being like, bam, put in that song. It'll make it seem like the scene is important, and it's nice to do that in a different context.
Yeah, I just watched that movie, The Arrival, with the that First Contact.
Yeah.
And they used, like, this amazing, like, classical track, and it was so exploitative. Like, at the end, it was just, like, building and building and building for, like, 5 minutes or something of this montage about childhood and love and stuff. It was
like every
outrageous.
Time Space Oddity turns up in something, and it's like, oh yeah, this is the moment, this is when everything matters.
Yeah.
I was driving home to William Tell Overture the other day on the radio, and it was like that. It was raining, and I just felt like I was the only person in this world, and something was about to happen, but it was just a traffic jam. Sorry, that's pretty irrelevant, but I tell you what is relevant. You just talked to Jim Noble over at Te Tuhi Theo, so should we segue into that little interview?
Yeah, so it's an interview with Jim Noble. We sort of jumped straight into it, so he begins by explaining what Dream Dialects is, which is a commissioned show at Te Tuhi at the moment.
Cool, here we go.
Dream Dialects is a mixed media art exhibition that... is a number of things. It's quite a compelling collection of New Zealand cultural artefacts. It draws together every edition of the book Smith's Dream by a New Zealand author and critic, C.K. Stead, that's been published, and all of the movie releases that I could find of the film Sleeping Dogs across different media. So it starts with those materials. As a way of considering, in one respect, the relationship between what those artworks of their time or time are doing in relation to a social and political and material context. For those of listeners who don't know the book and the film, they tell the story of the descent of a liberal democracy into the conditions of a totalitarian state, under the rhetoric of economic crisis and national security. And so I was just curious about how the stories are told, and then particularly what differs in the capacities of these as artworks. So, you know, one exemplifying the literary form and one the cinematic form. How is it that the same story kind of migrates and changes? What stays the same and what changes as we encounter this narrative and its concerns?
One of the iterations of the film you found is in the Air New Zealand Entertainment Dock, or whatever it's called.
So that's, one of the places I found it was on one of the many Air New Zealand flights that I've taken between here and various places since 2013. They also had the making of, so Dream in the Making, the making of Sleeping Dogs was also in the Air New Zealand itinerary. Seemed to have dropped off on the last journey I made, at least the last Trans-Pacific flight recently. But that's something that features in the show. So that's an example of one of the ways in which the movie circulates that I've collected and kind of appears in this collection of material forms in this exhibition.
So you've taken this existing content and you've kind of unpacked it through multiple different forms. You've replicated what could potentially be a prop from the film, although you don't know if it is. Would you mind sort of outlining how some of this unpackaging has happened?
Yeah, I guess I should say, like, the genesis of this project was coming here in 2013 to make a project with the New Zealand artist Maddie Leach at Skate Biennial. I'd been on one visit before then and then came back for that project and was introduced to the film Sleeping Dogs by Maddie. Her late father was the camera operator on that and a bunch of other really seminal examples of contemporary Kiwi cinema. She knew that I'd worked with movies as kind of one form of source material before as a way of generating different kinds of creative response. So I would start, often work in this way where a cultural artifact, an art form, and the materials that bear it is of interest to me, and I'll start, you know, watching and rewatching, or reading and reading, and thinking about examining the form, what it's made of, and getting into more and more detail in kind of how I start to unpack what kind of structure it has and what comprises it. I think I watched the movie first, like a really shitty copy on YouTube, and then was introduced to Smith's Dream, on which the movie was based, and discovered in drilling down a bit further into Smith's Dream that this curious phenomenon had happened where the author, Stead, had been given permission by the publisher to change the ending of the novel. And the ending of the novel that was changed, kind of the film borrowed one aspect of that, but not the other. And was thinking of kind of working with this relay across what the novel was doing. And so was alert to particular examples in the novel and in the film of what kind of technical devices are being used that are particular to those art forms that maybe the other one doesn't do or can't do. So what they share in one respect, comparing what they share, and then what differs. So just a kind of brief outline. At the beginning of the film, the protagonist, Smith, leaves circumstances of a broken marriage and broken family. His wife's got it on with his former best friend and left with the kids. And his response is this, is to escape. He just wants to go and live on an island and be alone. And his initial dream is this dream of autonomous solitude. And as he's escaping, driving out of Auckland up the Coromandel, he sees an island and knows when he sees it that that's where he wants to live and be alone. And he goes into a shop in a cafe in Coromandel to ask who owns the island. And on his way out of the shop, there's a poster in the window. And you can see the poster in the window that says, Disco Dance, Sat Night, RSA Hall, 8 p.m. to 12 midnight, live band, $2, refreshments provided. And a couple of things struck me as interesting about the poster. First of all, how cinema enables the incidental, like it enables the production of quite a detailed degree of texture to a world in a way that you don't have to attend to, but it's there, kind of enriching your experience of a narrative world in a way that literature can't do without drawing attention specifically to what it is that you're being asked to direct imagination towards. So if the poster were to appear in the novel, then it would be written about. It would be the focus of the narrative in this linear experience, whereas in the film, you may or may not notice it. You may not choose to, you know, to focus in among the other constituents of the situation that's being set. And the other thing that was interesting about the poster was whether or not it was a prop being made deliberately with the form of the disco in mind as to say something about this kind of particular village milieu, or whether it was an actual poster that was just in the shop window that was just kind of co-opted into the fiction. Maddie Leach's mum, Gretchen, so Gretchen's the wife of the late Paul Leach, who I mentioned was the camera operator, she said that it was run on such a shoestring that there's no way that they would have employed somebody to make a magic marker poster to go in a shop window. Like, it just had to be something that already existed. I'd made a copy of that poster as part of a process that's very integral to this show, which is working through an online contract management system to employ freelancers to do different kinds of things, to make different... It's called Upwork, it used to be called Odesk. Was working with that for a while, and then it kind of, you know, developed an interest in how much of an expression of a kind of contemporary form of political economy this phenomenon is. You know, on the one hand, it's beneficial and it enables people in one place to find someone elsewhere to do something for them in a price they can afford. It opens up a kind of a degree of freedom of labour for people elsewhere who can use computers to do work for people on the other side of the world that wouldn't necessarily be available to them if that kind of portal and network wasn't available. But at the same time, it is a kind of total expression of the kind of the vanguard of globalisation. It enables individuals on a very small scale to be able to exploit economic differentials. So the first project I did with it kind of creatively figures in the show is a piece called State of the Union. It's a bit of a kind of pithy, ironic, conceptual piece where I just advertised a job for a total of $10 asking for a graphic design treatment for logos for a series of labor unions for temporary workers. And I got, you know, a variety of very types of work in response. I got about 40 applications for the job, 40 people who were willing to do this total graphic design job for $10 US. And that then gets sort of resolved in the show as this kind of moving screen on which these things kind of scrub like an ad shell, in an ad shell style, through this kind of series of logos. Artistically, that it kind of expresses a particular strategy. But then the fact of being able to use the platform to effectively kind of employ studio assistants, which I, you know, couldn't do in either of the two places that I'm based, in Vancouver and Melbourne, that was a kind of, seemed to produce engagement with it as a necessity. But then it started to become more of an exploratory space through which possibility of making certain kinds of work, and then the kinds of personal conversations and relationships that can happen as a result of that start to become increasingly complex.
And you make a real point of making every single individual involved explicit. For the scene of Sleeping Dogs, which you've fabricated from the novel, you eliminate the credits, you eliminate the names of those involved with the filmmaking?
I guess to just kind of give a bit of context, the starting point for this project in terms of an idea for an artwork that then kind of spiraled into a whole series of other ones was, as I mentioned, noticing this difference between the two endings of the book. So the ending of the hardback cover, the protagonist, Smith, escapes this attack by the New Zealand military, sponsored by and supported by the US Air Force, US military, makes it far, far away from the conflict and winds up coming out of the bush and winds up on a beach and sees a woman beneath a blue beach umbrella with white tassels staring out to sea. And then in the paperback version that comes out 2 years later, that same scene, which in the first version is a kind of hopeful ending, or at the very least an ambiguous one, gets re-described as a dream that Smith recalls just before being shot in the back of the head. So a very different kind of ending in tone. But he retains this image and turns it into a dream. And for a book called Smith's Dream, that's quite an interesting phenomenon. It's an interesting thing to happen. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, for a dream that Smith has to appear at the very end of the book is like a big deal structurally.
I guess to some degree it's intrinsic to your project that these different iterations of the novel, the film, exist concurrently.
Yeah.
So in a sense, a reader could read both versions and consider one text and one subtext, or create a relationship where both are as true as each other. True being a strange word to use.
Yeah, I guess they provide alternative possibilities, so they do exist concurrently. And if you were to take them both on their own terms, an interesting question is, what does that difference make? What difference does it make to the novel that there is this figure in the form of a dream at the end? And to kind of to return to your question about the credits, so the movie borrows the grim ending of the second edition of the novel. He spoiler alert for those of you who who haven't seen the film yet, Smith gets it, and it does that without using the dream scene. So he dies, but they don't include the dream scene. I was interested in whether or not that may have been scripted and then in even shot and then rejected, mm-hmm. but apparently it wasn't scripted, even though, like, they didn't make it into the script. So I was interested in, like, okay, so what does the dream do in the novel? What does it kind of signify in the context of this, you know, book that's seemingly about maybe a kind of individualist aspiration in circumstances where socially and politically individual civil liberties are being destroyed and decimated, and the need for community is being generated by oppression? What does it mean that this character is dreaming of another, like a person coming into this dream? And how does that relate to what the film does? And the film, instead of using this figure of the dream, it does something else. And it does something else as part of a cinematic strategy. It's, you know, Roger Donaldson wanting to expand the potential of this novel into a movie that can spread around the world to tell a story that's more universal. Stead's novel is quite parochial in the sense of very deliberately looking at how aspects of a Kiwi consciousness, and maybe that's a kind of predominantly white male Kiwi consciousness, he's looking at how that could feed into the possibility of liberal democracy sliding into totalitarian. So Roger Donaldson and his team of writers, Arthur Basting and Ian Mune, they kind of make the context more universal. They take away that those kind of local concerns and observations that Stead has about kind of New Zealand mindset, a New Zealand mindset, and makes a film which succeeds in being this internationally distributed phenomenon of spreading kind of New Zealand creative culture around the world, as you'll see in the exhibit through the foreign languages of the film life.
And it is the first New Zealand film to be released internationally, in America.
Yeah, it's the first Kiwi film to get Hollywood distribution, and the film around which the New Zealand Film Commission came together.
You're listening to Artbank.
I break bread, ribs, $100 bills, dream about Bugattis and other four wheels. They say Illuminati and other ordeals is how my lawyer got me to avoid a raw deal. And now it's more real than it is for any other star. And that's enough to have you tearing up the mini bar. I should probably get awards when the Emmys are for how I deal with the path like Remy Ma. I get in the car like a sniper's on the roof now. But don't confuse how you see me have to move now. I got bars like a cypher's in the booth now. Ooh, child, things are gone. Get easier, long as they get my page right on Wikipedia, long as they say my name right in the media. If you don't, that's a sin like Cincinnati, cause ever since I had the polo suit at the Grammys, I've been spitting at the camera like Trick Daddy. So swaggy could've broke up with IG, I ain't surprised that they broke up on IG. I got the game on IV, might as well have a live feed. Keep a fresh cut from IB, so I always match the picture in my ID. Cause back in Dub C, it ran with Mac 10. I was still a baby Similac then. And with the crack era, did the black man. It had to be your era if you had a Cadillac then.
How I rock mine, I throw it up, making sure that you niggas all are on the same page. Have a full force, you better look both ways. Fuck that, I'm choking niggas, it's going down. I'm from a different cloth, we the oracles of the sound. Skip town, hit them with impeccable pound. Lost fam, the way that flooded niggas gon' drown. Rip shit, wait, I gotta do it again, You already know the script, roundhouse kick. She looking at me, licking her lip. Put my arm around her like a bowl of chip with a dip. With your bitch, what the fuck niggas erupt? I got the half moon clip, that's banana. A good planner, a new anger like a larger real spanner. Out the house, nigga, if you open your mouth. And nigga, if you open your mouth, fuck the press. I'm leaving every room in a mess like herds of bowl with the aprons on and baking soda. Keep it moving, keep the combo short and bring a case of Henny. House of pain, I control many. House of lies, when niggas go run hide. Keep the way to scribe conflict with they real lives. Phonetic shit be go bizarre. Bad news for niggas as I go emphatical, radical, national animal, ruling like a czar. Every time I black flip the record, the shit splatter. The whole data, no bullshit, the boom bapper. I pull together, whip the shit, cook the batter. When I pull up on niggas, even your mama gon' scatter. It's got.
So that was Tribe Called Quest, and you're tuned into Artbank 95BFM. We're just going to carry on with the interview with Jim Noble.
Talking about dream dialects at Tatui.
Here we go.
You're not from New Zealand. How do you engage with something that's been described as sacrosanct New Zealand culture?
I think I felt like there's a certain kind of permissiveness that comes with being from somewhere else, and certainly being invited. You know, I was invited here to make work, and I was invited to consider that piece of work by someone whose own personal and family experience was entangled in the production. But it's also, you know, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that, because I'm not from here, and I didn't encounter all of the complex circumstances in which those cultural forms became entangled. So, you know, talking particularly about how the novel and the film especially, are regarded as prescient of the 1981 Springbok tour riots. You know, this is a massive period of civil upheaval, which I understand, you know, remains a kind of open wound that hasn't healed in some respects, that people still sit either side of a sustained divide around whether or not certain events then should have happened. But what I am used to doing in my way of working is to kind of poring over the material evidence of cultural events and phenomena. And it felt like a reasonably, it felt like a kind of respectful approach to investigating those events and their relationship to material cultural forms, to start making artistic responses. So the idea was, my first idea was to recreate the dream, to film the dream sequence and insert it into the film as a way of examining what the form of the dream was doing and what its significance was and how it might affect how we think about what's going on in the novel, in the film. So I came to New Zealand last year and worked with a great cinematographer called Ian Powell and the great crew here at Te Tuhi, worked with Bruce Phillips, the curator, and Andrew Kennedy. They came and assisted on the shoot. And Gracie Taylor, she's a DJ here in Auckland. She was the talent for the shoot as well. You see her in the video. And Claire Hartley McLean was a production assistant on that. So we went up to Pakeri and Te Arai and shot these scenes. Pretty much exactly everything that was mentioned in the novel, we found places to shoot. We found places to shoot. And I had this idea of of inserting that into the film. You know, Donaldson is expanding the proposal story. One of the ways that he makes that happen is the alternative to the dream, and it's the Hollywood kind of solution or the kind of trope of the buddy movie. So whereas in the book, Smith, the kind of the end of the story is a kind of resolution of this history of political ambivalence, largely. Like, he gets all of this political agency projected onto him by the right-wing government and by the left-wing insurgency, but all the time, all the way through, he really just wants autonomous solitude on the island. And he gets, Stead punishes him in the rewrite. Like, he dies at the end because he's kind of being punished for his political ambivalence. Whereas in the movie, it's more like a redemption. It's a kind of redemption through a kind of buddy movie trope, where even though Ian Mune's character Bullen is now with Smith's wife and kids, Smith helps him at the end of the movie. He's been shot and he helps him through the bush to temporary safety. So at that point in the movie, that's when they both get it at the end. And they both die, and then the credits roll, and there's this wonderful song from the soundtrack, which was only ever released on vinyl, which is the theme tune to the film, as well as figuring a solution to shooting this dream scene and kind of inserting it into the film. I was also working with the soundtrack. I really like the soundtrack. It's got this great kind of combination of a kind of Kiwi take on Roy Cooder-style Americana, and on one hand, and on the other hand, this kind of sinister Lalo Schifrin-style funk. And I was sort of dealing with the soundtrack in a number of ways. Firstly, kind of taking it apart in the sense of listening for the repeated tropes, the kind of motifs that get used to identify a certain to lead a certain emotion in certain, or to identify with a certain character or place. And hit upon the idea of, there's a kind of circuitous way of talking about this, which is, it's kind of quite revealing of the way of how much of the way of working comes through this platform, this Upwork platform.
Upwork is essential to these kind of questions of, a liberal democracy. How much do you value labour?
It's expressive of a political economy in which labour has become fluid, or Sigmund Bauman call it liquid modernity. Like, we're in conditions where relatively secure conditions of labour that have existed previously for a short period of time, that include things like, you might get a pension with your job, or sick leave, or benefits. You might have some expectation of a degree of security with a job, or you might be represented by a labour union that seeks to defend your interests in terms of the price setting for the value of your labour. That's all been decimated since 1979, these are kind of reasonably useful markers, like the advent of the Thatcherite government in the UK and the Reagan administration in the US in 1984, particularly in New Zealand in the 1980s, were cut loose from the Commonwealth economy as sort of Thatcher was becoming increasingly kind of globalising in her politics, that New Zealand was forced into this position of innovating with its economy, the so-called New Zealand experiment, which has been quite heavily critiqued since then. Upwork is a great example of being able to work with people without taking responsibility, you know, as an employer, for example, without taking for their conditions. And,
yeah.
And that's not so different to any kind of freelance work in a way, but this just intensifies it in a way, and it also provides a mechanism through which companies and organizations that might otherwise be providing a degree of security or a certain kind of evaluation of somebody's labor can now be free of those responsibilities.
Cool. That was Theo McDonald talking to Jem Noble. We're almost done with Art Bank this week, but we should acknowledge the passing of Marty Freelander, who was a photographer who played an integral part in New Zealand's understanding of our own history. She photographed many important historical events as well as everyday New Zealanders throughout the 60s and up until recently. She died last week at the age of 88. Here she is talking about her life and times.
My life is almost over, but I've had such joy in photographing events from 1960s in New Zealand. I mean, how lucky can you be? I came to New Zealand, I was so incredibly lonely, and I thought to myself, now look around you, Marty. There are other migrants here, they're feeling the same. Why don't you take photographs of this strange country? And that's how it all began. I said to Gerard when we travelled around New Zealand, I have to take that photograph. I've never seen that before. Toi toi, you know, people, farmers, sheep. It was amazing. And in a way, I am so thrilled that I had that passion and desire to do it, because young people come up to me and they say, Marty, these photographs are marvellous. That's what New Zealand was like. And I say to them, because they write to me on my email every day, I want to be a photographer, and I say, do it. You think that you are so contemporary, but if you photograph what's around you now, in the future, young people will say, is that what it was like? So that's how you do it. No use saying I want to be a photographer. Do it. Photography, I mean, really has given me a wonderful gift, actually. It's enabled me to sort of just look at the world, not only through a camera, I wouldn't like that, but, you know, to actually engage with the world. Now that I'm about to depart the world, I feel so grateful for all that.
So that was Marty Freelander. That was a little excerpt from stuff.co.nz.